So the theme is spiritual friendship and the four tantric rites. So let's start with spiritual friendship. So you could say that it's what binds the Sangha together, really. And it's a kind of path in itself. Spiritual friendship is a way to develop compassion, wisdom, to find freedom, to find truth. And yeah, it you'll probably be familiar with the conversation between the Buddha and Ananda, and the Buddha told Ananda that friendship, spiritual friendship, was the whole of the spiritual life. So we quite often talk about that, make reference to that story, because spiritual friendship is a very key, almost feature of Triratna as a Sangha. So it has a Pali term, Kalyana Mitrata. Mitra is a term, all of you are Mitras, so you've heard this before. Bhante describes the friend, it's a way of being a friend, someone who feels strong, unselfish and active love, or metta. And mitrata means friendship characterized by those qualities. So I'm going to talk a bit more about the qualities themselves, because I think those are really interesting words in Bhante's quote. So strong love. So it's not limp, it's not sort of wet, it's not vaguely warm, it's not nice. And I was listening to some talks on this theme. There's some really lovely talks by Vajra Tara from Tiratna Loka, and she tells this story of Dilgo Khyentse Rinpoche, who was one of Bhante's teachers, and he was a very great Nyingmapa master, and apparently when he had an evening off, he would gather his disciples together and he would tell them stories of his teachers, and as he spoke, tears would just run down his face. He would just be so moved with the recollection, the evocation of these teachers. So there's something very sort of deeply felt there, isn't it? It's not sort of just a bit, I quite like them. You know, it's just really heartfelt and almost, you could almost use the word passionate. So that's strong. Unselfish, so in terms of not being self-referential. You don't offer friendship for the purpose of some sort of payback, that this person will stick around or will like you or help you or be useful to you in some way. So it's not based on neurotic need to fill some sort of gap. And although described like that, you could perhaps think, oh, well, I wouldn't relate to a friend like that. Actually, it can be really, really subtle in the way that you just want that person. Sometimes, you know, you meet someone in the centre and you're really warm to them and they seem really inspired and they really want to be here, and you spend lots of time talking to them, and then the next week they don't come back and you never see them again. And there's that little sort of slightly kind of, you know, sort of a bit for yourself, you know, because you were getting something from that and you wanted to kind of have them here. So yeah, very, very subtle end of that. But in a way, the ideal is that you just offer friendship without any particular expectation of anything else. And then there's active. So it's not just feeling it, it needs to be embodied and expressed. Metta is something that has action and expression behind it. So that's the kind of mitrata bit. And then we come to the word kalyana. So the root of this word, kal, apparently means to impel, incite or urge on. So it has that sense of being morally beneficial. And Bhante translates it as spiritual, but I don't think he was particularly happy with that translation, because spiritual is in a certain way kind of vague, kind of a word, and Bhante, we know, is very precise in his language. So he defines spiritual, interestingly, as dwelling in skillful mental states, or ever more skillful mental states. So Kalyana is translated as helpful, morally good, but also can be translated as beautiful, which implies what is morally good is beautiful. So the combination of those words, again, is quite an interesting thing to reflect on. So Kalyana Mitrata leads us on to higher levels. It takes us up the spiral path. It takes us into states of peace and wisdom. So it's a very high ideal. And I suppose you can begin to see how spiritual friendship could be a path, because it's taking you further into those states of peace and wisdom. And in relationship, of course, it helps you to see things about yourself, I think, that perhaps you wouldn't notice if it was not in a dynamic with someone else. Sometimes people get a little bit uncomfortable with this explanation of Kalyana Mitrata and spiritual friendship, the whole area of spiritual friendship. They begin to think that it's saying that you shouldn't have Buddhist friends, or you shouldn't have friends outside the Buddhist world, or you should sort of go and dump them or something. That only Buddhists make worthwhile friends. It really, really doesn't mean that. You don't just dump your non-Buddhist friends. I quite often talk about my friend, my oldest friend, Hilary, when I'm talking about friendship. I met her when I was 21. And she went towards academia and sort of liberal politics and Quakerism, probably, is her strongest spiritual influence. And I call her my most successful friend because she's a lecturer at Cambridge now. And our lives sort of have similarities, so we've done some similar kinds of work, we're interested in similar kinds of things, and differences. So she has two children in their 20s now. But our communication has a quality to it. We can tell each other anything. We can really investigate what we feel, what we want to do with our lives, how we feel about our closest relationships. We have these times together. We usually go out for lunch or something. Not very frequently, maybe once a year, twice if we're lucky. And these are like markers through our lives, you know, for all of those years, these milestones where we review, you know, what's it like to be alive? And we're exactly the same age. So we, you know, like I do think I have those kind of, it's like a depth charge kind of going on in our lives periodically from year to year over many, many years now. So I would call Hilary a spiritual friend, actually. Enormously enriching, our friendship has been enriching, and soothing, is that the right word? Kind of healing as well. You know, we've been through some very big ups and downs together too, so we kind of reach out for each other when things are difficult. Kalyana Mitrata, some of you may know, it's actually a formal relationship in Trivratna. I'll say a bit more about what I mean by that in a minute. Friendships between people who have different levels of experience. So most often it's between someone who's training for ordination and two order members who become Kalyana Mitras to that person. Or could be, sometimes it's a newish order member and two other more experienced order members. And they undertake to be friends in the sense that I've just evoked, to help each other progress in the Dharma life, to help each other live life in the most beneficial and creative way possible. And it's lifelong. And there is a ceremony that can happen. There's a celebrant, who's often a preceptor perhaps to one of the people, senior order member, and they have a ceremony, the four of them. Yeah, the four of them. There's always two Kalyana Mitras. I had two informally before I was ordained, but the ceremony was after I was ordained. The other day I met my, I don't know if this is strictly a term, I met my Kalyana Mitra granny. So I was house-sitting for a friend in Herefordshire, and she said, oh, I've just been on the phone to Pamba Vadri, who's my Kalyana Mitra, and she said, I'm her Kalyana Mitra. And I said, that makes you my Kalyana Mitra granny. So that was really nice, actually, that sort of sense of kind of connection between all of us. So though there can be a difference in experience, there's a mutuality in it. Both give and receive friendship, lift each other up on the path. So it's got that ascending quality. So a couple of little thoughts about friendship, a few more thoughts before I move on to the rites, the tantric rites. One of Bhante's aphorisms is, if you want a friend, you need to be a friend, which I think is quite worth a lot of reflection, actually. And Vajratara, in the talk she gave on this subject, was making the point that you also need to be able to be befriended, to allow yourself to receive friendship. That's part of the mutuality of the relationship. And again, there's perhaps some quite subtle areas there, how much you allow yourself to be befriended and how much you trust that when you go to a friend and need some help, perhaps, I think this is perhaps quite a common pattern, if you need help and you are you then really willing to reach out to a friend and say, you know, I need help? That's the kind of aspect of being befriended, and I know for myself I have to struggle with that a little bit. Why friendships are important in the spiritual life? You could probably do several talks on that topic alone. I'll quote Bhante here to get a pithy sort of overview of this, his thoughts. I'll read it twice. Personal relationships are necessary for human development. This applies at all levels, cultural, psychological and spiritual. The vast majority of people undoubtedly develop most rapidly and even most easily in the company of others, or at least in contact with others. Personal relationships are necessary for human development. This applies at all levels, cultural, psychological and spiritual. The vast majority of people undoubtedly develop most rapidly and even most easily in the company of others, or at least in contact with others. So I was reflecting on this a bit in terms of this universality of the need for friendship and how we don't thrive when we're isolated. Really the kind of playing with the kind of truth of and the kind of flip side of Bhante's quote there. So bear with me. This is a sort of little glimpse of my world here. On Thursday night, another order member, an order member called Parami, who some of you have met, I know and know, so she recommended I watched a documentary about the alt-right. We were sort of texting each other, and she said, oh, I went to see this documentary last night, scary, but recommend it. So I found it, and it was called Undercover with the Alt-Right, and it was produced by a group called Hope Not Hate, which is a sort of anti-racist group in the UK. I don't know if they're wider. And you're probably familiar with the term alt-right, but if not, they're a kind of far-right grouping. They operate online mostly, and they're broadly racist, even with a sort of white supremacist sort of tinge to them. They're very anti-Jewish, they're anti-Muslim, and they're anti-left, they're anti-feminist, and they have been much encouraged by the election of Donald Trump. And what happened was this young Swedish man went undercover probably a rather a dangerous exercise, and he managed to gain trust in the network and found some of the most influential voices in that particular world, in that particular network. And after the film, I went to look for some of the videos to see how they're presenting themselves, because they have this kind of quite big online presence. Although actually I think it's kind of they're being kind of circumscribed a bit by the platforms now. But I was watching one British vlogger, and he did seem in a really bad state, actually. He seemed really unwell, physically, mentally. And I imagine the mental states needed to keep those kinds of very hate-based views going, the dynamics of the far-right network. They seem very isolated, very paranoid, very factionalised, mistrustful. And the video I was watching was him appealing for donations for therapy, which he couldn't afford. And obviously I really hope that he is well and gets well. And I also hope that in wellness he is able to unhook from those very toxic kind of points of view, which are no good for him or anyone else. But it really highlighted that need of friendship, you know, whatever you're doing, even that very sort of other world to the world that I'm familiar with, even in a world with almost the kind of polar opposite kind of value systems to mine, you still need friendship and companionship and alliance. And this is why we practice within a Sangha. We don't fare well, really, without it. But what I'll do when we set up the discussion groups is I'll suggest perhaps you could talk a little bit more about your own experience of why friendship is important in the spiritual life, or if you agree with that, you know, you'd like play with that idea. So that's what I've done there is to kind of paint a bit of a backdrop on the topic of spiritual friendship. And now I'm going to talk about the tantric rites, which is where we get into the sort of all the sort of mystery and magic and all that stuff, which is great. So tantric Buddhism then. So it began to emerge in India in the 8th century. And we most often refer to it now, sometimes we'll more refer to it as the Vajrayana or the Diamond Way. And a feature of it is a direct encounter with reality, with life, engaging the whole idea really, or an aspect of the idea is to engage with day-to-day realities of life around the practitioner, their cultural life, their everything life. And one of the ways that people kind of made sense of and manipulated their world in a culture which was kind of pre-science and pre-technology was magic. So there are very many different sort of magic rites, rituals. People would have kind of gone to practitioners, magical practitioners, who would have helped them with some sort of aspect of their life. And we're going to use these rites, four rites of tantric Buddhism, I'm going to explain in a minute. We're going to use them as a way of delving a little more into different aspects of spiritual friendship. So they're a kind of model or a vehicle that we'll use to explore the topic of friendship. So at this point, Paramartha, could you turn the flip chart around? Thank you. Okay. So So that's a list of the four rights that we're going to talk about. And first of all, I'm going to talk about them in terms of the mundane version of them. And then I'm going to talk about how we can use the rights in our lives in the Sangha in terms of friendship. So the red rite of fascination. So with this, we're talking about kind of love magic, really. You know, if you want to draw someone to you, you want to kind of reel them in, there would be a magical ritual that you could be done probably on your behalf that would kind of ensnare and entrap the person that you had an eye on. So that was the red rite of fascination. And then there's the black or sometimes the blue rite of destruction. So this is probably the kind of magic that those scary films that I'm too frightened to watch are all about. So about sort of destruction of enemies and putting curses on people and pinning down the people who are your enemies, something like that. And then there's the white rite of pacification. So this is all about calming down turbulence, creating peace, getting the demons to just go or quieten down or something like that. So it's that kind of has that kind of calming quality. And then finally, there's the yellow rite of prospering. So some of you who know the mantla of the five Buddhas, so this is the dana, the Ratnasambhava, the yellow symbolism of the yellow. The colours, by the way, are quite important in this. They're very they're meaningful. They're very strong in the symbolism of these in these rites. And the yellow rite of prospering, obviously, is about enrichment, wealth, that which makes the crops and the harvest abundant. There are probably certain times of year when these kinds of rites were carried out. Could even be links to some of our sort of our Western cultural festivals and so on. I'm thinking of like Harvest Festival. I wouldn't be at all surprised if that had come out of some sort of pagan magic around abundance. But it's not an area I know about particularly, but some of you might. So it'd be interesting to kind of reflect on the parallels within the more traditional European traditions. So the Buddhist tantric siddhas, the practitioners, the tantric practitioners, transformed those magic rites into benign powers so that they could use them to change themselves and compassionately help other beings to transform themselves. So one of the lovely things about preparing a talk like this is I get to kind of listen to all these amazing talks and read these things which I wouldn't normally kind of make the time to do or something. And I was listening to a talk by Padmavajra yesterday where he was saying that the tantricas, the practitioners of this particular approach, they were really into singing, which as most of you who know me, that is a really, really great discovery. And that was one of their ways of communicating. And apparently the Balls of Bengal, who are a contemporary, they're wandering singers. They go around and they do these very sort of passionate, wild, sometimes ecstatic kind of singing. And some of them are Sufi Muslim mystics. Apparently the Balls of Bengal are the direct descendants of the tantric siddhas. So I was thinking, oh, that's exciting, because that's a kind of and I keep trying to find why sound and singing seems to evoke some alchemy in the way that I relate to the world. So that was a fascinating little snippet that came in from Padmavajra's talk. So now here's the thing. So this is what we're sort of building to here. So we've looked at spiritual friendship. We've looked at the rites in the mundane sense. So now the kind of key question is how we can use the rites in our lives, in Sangha, in friendship. And it's kind of challenging, isn't it, for our very secular, scientific, materialistic way of thinking. Can we kind of evoke those kind of magical powers and use them in a way which is meaningful to us? So you can see it as a metaphor, you can see it as sort of mystic, poetic, symbolic end of the tradition. So we're going to look at each rite in turn, and then we're going to look at how this particular rite can be applicable to our Sangha life more broadly, and also within our relationships within the Sangha as a whole. And when I was planning this talk, or finalising this talk really, it was all happening with the backdrop of the Observer article. So obviously it's a time of community debate and intensity, a time when the order and movement are identified very collectively from that outside perspective. And we are talking about us more, perhaps with more energy and focus than we perhaps usually would. So for each rite, I'm going to reflect a little bit on how we can use the rite within those sort of more global, broader scale conversations about ourselves, and also within our friendships as well. And I'm going to start with the black rite of destruction. So this is about destroying what holds us back. So in the tantric sense, it's about destroying what holds us back, impediments to what blocks and limits us. And I was thinking in terms of the way that these kinds of critical media coverage like we've had over the last week, and I'm sure it won't be the last time. It's kind of a time that for very courageous conversations, I think. It's being able to be willing to question our assumptions. So when you're in the kind of firing line of strong public criticism like that, our own ability to ask difficult questions and be able to enter conversations sometimes without necessarily knowing what our answer is or what the solution is or even really what we think on everything. And there's a danger then we can close off to criticism or dismiss it because it raises awkward dissonance. So we've got, I'm sure, a kind of story of ourselves, like most people and most groups of people, that we are good people. And yet it's dissonant with, in this case, an article about, you know, how we're a bunch of people who mistreat each other and can't do anything about it or something like that. That was the kind of gist of it. And one of the things that can come out of this is some really kind of interesting new thinking and ideas. So I was standing at the front door on a Monday evening, the day after actually the article came out, and a mitra that some of you will know, Helen Rabo, came through the door, and she recommended a talk by a woman called Margaret Heffernan, H-E-F-F-E-R-N-A-N, called Dare to Disagree, and it's a TED talk. And the talk is a very inspiring illustration of the way in which different points of view, even conflicting points of view, are gateways to answers and different perspectives. So they're ways that our kind of habits of thinking can be challenged and lead to breakthroughs and solutions. So she says in this TED talk that it's a way to think that different points of view, even antagonistic points of view, are ways that we can think. And the problem is that most people avoid disagreeing if they can. I certainly know I do. I will do anything to avoid disagreeing. in a kind of conversation. And so what she's saying is we lose the opportunity that a conflicting point of view offers us. So that black rite of destruction can be very fertile and also a bit scary, but it can be, in terms of transformation, it can be really, really helpful. And I think as time's gone on, as the week's gone on, and some of the ideas that the Adistana Kula have been coming out with, which I know all of you have seen, I'm fairly sure, some of the energy around these kind of antagonistic, the antagonism or criticism from the mainstream press can kind of can be turned into a kind of more creative, more energetic, braver way of asking and addressing some important questions any community would need to address, like how can we best protect people from harm? How best can we make sure that our ethical values are as fully and properly upheld in our community as they possibly can be? So we can use this black rite also very carefully in our relationships. So it's powerful and can be very beneficial, but if there's any ill will in it, it can be cruel, undo damage, and of course that's the great danger. And so it does depend a lot on the circumstances and the nature of the relationship and how much trust there is in the relationship. But you can really find, or I've really found, that someone who doesn't collude with you is sometimes the kindness you need. So someone who challenges you can be the greatest gift. So I have a very straight-talking friend based in Sheffield called Kema Suri. So that's not Kema Siri in Nottingham, another lovely friend. Kema Suri. And I was ordained with her in India. And there was a time in my life when I was obsessively and embarrassingly, in retrospect, going on about someone I didn't like, and I'd go on and on and on about this person I didn't like. And she used to say to me, very straight, very kindly, "You're bigger than this, Maitrisara." And it was a bit like... but it was really the challenge I needed. I really needed to sort of dig myself out of this kind of thing that I was doing over and over again. And that wasn't the only time she gave me a bit of a talking to. Usually just with one sentence, which stopped me in my tracks, and as a result I steered away from doing some unskillful things I would have really regretted. So this is the rite of destruction in the context of a personal relationship, but like I say, it does take a lot of trust and needs a lot of self-awareness to avoid the pitfall of doing it with ill will and therefore hurting someone. So we're going to move on to the red rite of fascination. So how can this be? You know, fascination, entrancement, seduction. How does this work in Buddhism when craving is seen as the source of suffering? well, in a way, here we are with strong, unselfish, active love again, metta. So thinking about this in the relationship to the Sangha broadly, when we have difficult, brave conversations, I've noticed on numerous occasions that the people that tend to bear the brunt of turbulence are those in leadership positions. So the people in Triratna that were getting together to think about how to respond to the circumstances of the Observer article were the chairs, the Mitra conveners, the senior order members, the safeguarding team. You know, all of those people are the ones who are trying to kind of carry situations. And so they really need love. They really need love. And I think that we quite easily get into this kind of blame the boss kind of, you know, they should have done something kind of thing. And they really, really need love. Not in the sense that nothing should be expected of them or that they shouldn't be held accountable or anything like that, but in the sense of empathy and giving them the benefit of the doubt that they have done their best and they're doing their best. And when the article was published, I sent some messages off to the safeguarding team, a couple of people who are friends of mine. And I knew it would fall on them. I knew it would have fallen on them. And that was actually one of the delightful things about last week. There was so much warmth towards us, particularly, and other order members, I expect. But I just really experienced it as a kind of real kind of affirmation. And which doesn't mean to say that some people didn't have questions and some of them were a bit cross. And, you know, there was also sort of some energy of kind of, yeah, turbulence is the word I use. But I do really appreciate that. Little email messages, texts, people's conversations. It was just lovely. So that's what I mean. So that's in the sort of the bigger scale, in the day-to-day friendship scale. It's probably obvious that the role of delight, cherishing and care, to love a friend for who they are in themselves. So metta, you could say, is a kind of love magic. So I have a Kalyana Mitra, I've mentioned already, Padmavajri. And we will just always be aware of what's going on for each other. So we've never lived, while we've been in this Kalyana Mitra relationship, we've never lived in the same town. But we've had an hour on the phone every month for the last 15 years, without fail. So she's been, well, we've been alongside each other at particular times in life. So one of those, I remember, she'd gone to considerable trouble. I lost my mum, I think it was about, well, in 2003 anyway. And she came to the funeral, which was in Shropshire, a very long way away from where she lived. And my preceptor, Ratnavandana, came too. And I remember we buried my mother in an orchard, and I was standing at the end of the grave, and the coffin went down, and I was kind of, had found myself kind of at the head of it, of the grave, at the head end. And I just really became aware of a presence behind me. And I just knew sort of two beings were there that were kind of Kalyana Mitras to me, in the kind of biggest sense of the word. I wasn't quite sure who it was. And when I turned around, Ratnavandana, my preceptor, and Padmavajri, my Kalyana Mitra, were standing right behind me, flanking me, you know, like on one shoulder and the other shoulder. And they were just like, I just felt this, you know, kind of presence of them. So that's the kind of strength of love and support that we can talk about in the area of spiritual friendship. So the white rite of pacification. So this is about the quality of bringing calm, creating peace. It's very, very important, that capacity. And it's easy to destroy things, isn't it, really? It's easy to knock things down, to sow suspicion. It's especially easy to do that when people are under stress. It's the oldest trick in the book, really. The Nazis were very good at it, to get people to blame each other. The alt-right, I've mentioned, also use this device, blame the immigrants. And when people have been betrayed in the past, it's understandable that their trust can be fragile and cynicism and disillusionment can arise quite quickly. So people who are able to use the white rite of pacification draw, I think, on confidence, even faith. So when we're being criticised, I know that I can respond better if I call on a faith and confidence from within myself. And it helps me to be more flexible and more creative, and I'm less likely to close off. So I just think in those times, the ability to kind of stay open to the difficult conversations and kind of stand in a kind of shraddha, a faith in our own integrity, really, and goodness. So the first meditation I did after the Observer article, I think probably the following morning, an image arose which I went with of a journeying down into a kind of basement within myself, like what was down in the basement, what resources could I kind of call on? Was there anything down there? Was there any inspiration? Was there any energy? Was there any confidence? Was there any faith? Was there anything? any ideas. And I just kind of let the sense of what was there emerge, and I just got the sense of there was a huge amount down there, actually. There was a huge amount to call on. There was plenty down there. And I could call on it and needed to call on it. And we can get confidence from others as well. I knew that I had a deep love and respect for our community and our ability to weather turbulent times, and we've done it before. I had a huge amount of trust in Dharmashala and Singamati, who I was going, just after this meditation, I was going to trot off down the road to sit on their sofa and have a bit of a meeting about all of this. And in personal relationships, so that's how it works sort of on a broader scale in times of difficulty. But in personal relationships, I think we can offer each other a kind of steadiness where one of us is in a time of chaos or crisis, or at any point actually, doesn't even need those moments. So to be steady, to show up, to hold a space which can contain what's going on for people, to contain what people are going through. Faith is infectious, I've decided. I kind of guess why that's puja is a collective practice, because that infectious nature of faith can just kind of like spread about. So finally we come to the yellow rite of prospering. On that Monday morning of that meeting I just described with Singamati and Dharmashalan, day after the article. So we got onto the sofa with some quite nice chocolate, I remember. It was Hotel Chocolat from your wedding, wasn't it? Anyway, that helped. We started to talk about the various voices that are part of this, the order discourse about these kinds of issues. And Dharmashalan started talking about the silent majority, those that don't write on the online threads, that don't tend to be that vocal, express what they're feeling and thinking about this or that initiative or this or that. And one of the senior women order members had written online, on an online thread, kind of pleading for anyone who, with any ideas or thoughts or suggestions or perspectives, to offer them to the Sangha, to find a way to do that, whatever way that is, to find a way to do that. She was kind of saying the time is now. And Singamati had been inspired by that and seen that too, seen that plea. That we need to participate, we need to contribute. And I know I find that difficult myself. I really find online kind of chat in those spaces difficult. I don't know what it is, I feel almost phobic about it. And even, I'm not even 100%, some of you might find this surprising, I'm not 100% at ease with sort of contributing to discussion either, especially if there's kind of disagreement, don't like that. So I will push myself. I mean, I know that it's important to do that and I will push myself, but it doesn't come naturally to me at all. But contributing your ideas and thoughts is a way of giving. Singamati was very much saying in that meeting, you know, we need to find a way to participate and contribute and have a voice, all of us, or as many of us as possible. And in a community where things need working out, there will be no way forward if people don't contribute to the conversation, don't offer ideas. It's a way of giving yourself to something. So I like to think that at least some of my ideas are relatively kind of useful. So why do I hold back from offering them? It's a lack of, maybe it's a lack of generosity in a way, or maybe it's like my ego can't quite cope with being disagreed with. Maybe it's something to do with a kind of going forth from a sort of self-referential habit there. So those are the ways that we can contribute to Sangha life in terms of the yellow rite of prospering. Giving, it's all about contributing, giving, giving attention, giving ideas, joining in. And in relationship, with your friends, you can also give your attention, your encouragement. You can contribute questions, reflections, ideas, without necessarily slipping into advice giving or telling people what to do, which is not usually very helpful or very enjoyable to be on the receiving end of. One of the things about stories of the Buddha from the Pali Canon I've been noticing recently is how much the Buddha stays in there with people. So a conversation will start up and it will just go back and forth and back and forth, and the person will be saying something and the Buddha will say, no, but, you know, and he'll, you know, that he really kind of like piles in. He's like, he's throwing himself into the relationship. And one of the things I like about that painting downstairs with Kisa Gotami and the Buddha is the way that the Buddha is like really kind of, he's really with Kisa Gotami, you know, his arms are outstretched, he's looking at her. And it's actually relatively rare to see the Buddha in a dynamic relationship there, depicted in a dynamic relationship. But that's what those conversations described in the Pali Canon seem to, particularly been striking me over the last few months, is how kind of there with someone he is. I mean, you do that very much as well with people, and Saraha used to do it a lot. And it's a real gift to a friendship, actually, that. So the last point I'm going to make is to talk about the qualities together and the way the rites balance each other and can work together. So where there's the rite of destruction is being used, as I said, it can be dangerous, it can go wrong, it can be destruction in the damaging sense rather than in the kind of transformative sense. There needs to be love, the rite of fascination, and there needs to be steadiness and calm and faith, pacification. And maybe because destruction can also be damaging, it can be enlivening, clarifying, energizing and transforming, or it can be damaging if it's mixed with ill will. So for to have those other two rites to balance it out, to save it from its damaging forms, we have the red rite of fascination, of love, to offer challenge in the spirit of love, in the service of love. It's extremely potent. And we have the rite of pacification, calm, confidence, faith, shraddha. So again, where the black rite of destruction can be sort of tipping over and kind of overflowing its pot, you've got this kind of container that it can be within. And the bigger the perspective, the bigger the container, and the more that can be held. So shaking things up with the black rite of destruction, but rooted in a sense that we don't have to fear, we don't have to defend, we're on solid ground. So those three seem to really work together and kind of counterbalance and ameliorate each other in a way. And then you've got the yellow rite of prospering, which is about giving, encouraging, contributing, participating, entering into relationship. So just as an example, I think because I was thinking about these rites, because the Observer article was kind of being debated last week, I think it changed. I was saying to Paramatha earlier, I think it changed the way that I was communicating. I was kind of more in the background, more in the background than in a kind of conscious, clunky way. I think it was sort of like suffusing me and kind of affecting the way that I was thinking about things. So on Sangha night, so this was the Thursday, so 4 days later, I went into the Sangha night group. Helen was there, I think. That's the only one here. I basically said to the Sangha night group, I was offering them the choice between either coming to me with me to talk about the Observer article or to stay very ably held by Nick and Veronica, who kind of held the main group. And I just went to the front and I gave them the choice, so they didn't know this was happening. And this is what I said, something like this. Over the weekend, there was a newspaper article in The Observer which was very critical of Triratna. The first thing I want to say is that I'm very proud of Triratna, and I would have no hesitation in suggesting that you go to any of our centres or any event led by any order members. At the same time, it's very important to us to be able to discuss any criticisms we receive in an open-hearted way, with the possibility that there is something to learn and in the spirit of non-defensiveness. So for that reason, I'm offering you the option to meet in a small group to discuss anything you'd like to. So in that, I start by saying, I want to say that I'm very proud of Triratna, and I would have no hesitation in suggesting that you go to any of our centres or any with any teachers in the order. So a sort of faith, you know, sort of like setting out a kind of pacification, holding faith space, like a confidence and a sort of... this is with me reflecting backwards, by the way. I didn't think of it the other way around. This is reflecting from this place. And then... at the same time, it's very important to us to be able to discuss any criticism we receive in an open-hearted way. So I'm setting out a kind of meta, a context of let's meet this with meta rather than with defensiveness or anger or attack or anything like that. With the possibility that there's something to learn and in the spirit of non-defensiveness. So I'm inviting, let's bring on a bit of destruction. You know, let's actually kind of question the unquestionable, ask the unaskable, ask if you are worried about this, because it really matters to have conversations about how to protect everyone to the best of our ability. And then I offer them the option to meet in a small group, so offering them the opportunity to participate, which I will also step into. So that's the kind of prospering part of it. And like I say, I didn't think about it in advance that that's what I was doing, but I can see it now, that I was kind of weaving all four rights together. And I don't think, when I've invited people into spaces to discuss tricky issues before, I don't think I've ever done it like that quite before. I don't know how it came across. I mean, Nick and Helen was there. I don't know how it came across, but I felt like for the first time I'd kind of really offered the invitation in the way I really wanted to, something like that. So those are the rites as they relate to Kalyana Mitrata. You can have fun applying the rites to lots of different things, actually. They're very adaptable and very transferable into different themes. So this is a bit of a worked example of the way that you can apply the rites to this particular topic. And I'll leave it there. Thank you.